Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Sean Scanlon, the controller here in this lovely state of Connecticut, joining us for the whole hour. We're going to do player of the game in a second, but good morning.
Good morning.
The hair looks good.
Thank you. Yours does too.
Well, you know.
We're hair guys.
I mean, you. The thing I don't do that you do is that I don't, like, I have the wet look. I need to sort of eschew the wet look, but I'm afraid to, it's like my whoopee. It's like my blanket. You know what I mean? I don't want to lose the wet look. Whereas you look like you sat in a chair and somebody blew dry it out every morning, right?
I can assure you that didn't happen.
Anyway, we have a ton of real serious things to talk about this morning, from the budget to the big picture for the Democratic Party, healthcare, first responders, Tweed New Haven Airport, our children, a lot of things to discuss. But what's on the agenda today? What do you got going?
I got a big bill that the House of Representatives is going to run today that reforms the municipal pension system. This is our third year in a row that we've had a big bill reforming the municipal pension system. Your listeners are already falling asleep.
But right. And it's failed the previous 2 years?
No. We've passed huge bills each year. And I view
Why don't you reform it right the first time?
This is the third movie in the trilogy.
Okay. Is this the last one?
I think so. Yeah.
And so you assume if it passes the House, it'll pass the Senate, and you know the governor will sign it?
God willing, man.
Okay.
I mean,
I'd like to know why you need three different shots at reforming the municipal pension system.
Three different things. So, real quick.
No, you better do it quick.
First one.
Yeah.
We stabilize the finances of the existing pension system and save the taxpayers in 117 of the 169 towns who are part of this $800 million.
Okay.
The second year, we changed the governance structure of it so that it's now controlled by municipalities and the workers, rather than being a sideshow in the retirement commission that's all about the state employee system. And this year, we're creating MERS 2.0, which is a new plan to entice both new towns to join MERS and new police departments and fire departments specifically, because this is really aimed at the recruitment and retention.
How do you incentivize them?
Because it's offering an affordable pension, which for years people have been moving away from the pensions because they haven't been affordable. This is an affordable product. And it also helps the existing MERS towns, because after July 1 of a couple of years down the road, every new police officer or firefighter or DPW guy they hire is in MERS 2.0, not MERS 1.0. All these things together, I think, will save MERS.
We got to take a break. I'd like to know why it's more manageable for the municipalities from a cost perspective. We're here with Sean Scanlon, comptroller here in Connecticut. I'll give you sort of the choice. I mean, where do you want to start this morning? I mean, we can go serious, we can go fun, we can go family. What do you want to do?
Wherever you want to go. It's your ship, man. Take us where you want to go.
That sounded like something. You ever see the Target ad with shipping my pants? So they go, oh, there he goes, I can ship my pants? He said, it's my ship, and I thought you were saying something else. Can I ask you, go random, go with Tweed for
go
a second?
Because
I've never asked you about it.
Yeah.
Has it grown the way you anticipated it when you were dealing with them? And what are they? And I don't want you to be critical of the people that run it now, but in the neighborhood, it seems like it's a disaster, right? And I think for people who fly out of their busy times, it's a disaster. Are they going to be able to, with the real estate they have, sort of fulfill their dreams?
So just to level set for your listeners, before I was the comptroller, I was the CEO of Tweed Airport.
Correct.
And my first day there, everyone I knew said I was killing my career to go work there. But I was very attracted to this idea of intractable problem, right? For 50 years, people have been trying to expand that airport and they couldn't do it, right? The first day I got there, we had one flight every other day to Philadelphia, 49,000 annual passengers and like 15 employees. And on the day I left to take this job, we had 1 million passengers, We had 17 nonstop daily destinations. Now they're up to, I think, 25.
But some people say that's a problem.
And 250 employees. Now they're up to 400 employees.
But it doesn't, can they fit it?
We've created jobs, or they've created jobs now, because I don't work there anymore. They created a lot of jobs. They've created a lot of economic development. And they've created a lot of opportunity for people to be able to use that airport for the first time in decades. Do they have the room to do it? Yes. Are they stalled in the project? Yes, they are. Because
who's stalling them?
Because this is sort of the problem, and we can talk about this with the Democratic Party in a second. This is an easy segue. Is there's a big debate right now in my party about, have we overregulated the heck out of the world? And as a result of that, is it just hard to get things done? We become, the perfect is the enemy of the good. When I did a deal to expand the airport, we announced that in November of 2021. It is now May of 2025. They have gotten some of the approvals, but they have not gotten all the approvals. That's almost four years have gone on. What's taking so long? Why does it take so long? It's because these processes really bog down these projects.
Is it the city of New Haven? Is it?
No, it's a combination. It's the federal government. It's the state government. It's the town of East Haven where they want to put this terminal. I think it grew, to answer your question, though, a lot faster. I believed it was like Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. And that clearly has been proved.
Right.
The challenge now is, can they make that growth sustainable until they can build that new building? And that's where they're having trouble, right? There are people waiting. It's not a big deal now because it's nice. But in February, there's people queued up waiting outside for an airplane, right? They have to figure that out, and there's no easy solutions. I've been there. I wish them the best of luck. I don't really talk to them anymore. I'm not involved in the day-to-day.
Right.
But I'm always a believer in what that airport can be for our state and our region, and I'm really, 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 really proud of the work that I did.
Yeah, I think it is a great opportunity. The more destinations, the better it is for people who don't want to deal with JFK or LaGuardia or Newark or Boston. And I just think that eventually, if it's too difficult to do, people will not go there, and then the capacity will be reduced because people don't go there, and then it sort of almost eats itself. So, I mean, I just wanted to ask you, because I never actually talked to you about that.
It's the hardest thing in any business, right? You talk to any small business owner, they're like, I've perfected this thing, I've got this product, and now when I go to scale it up, how do I keep it perfect, right? How do I keep it from my hands, right? It's a hard thing to do.
We'll talk about the budget at 840. Since you brought up the party, we're talking with Sean Scanlon, candidate controller, and a lot of people, again, he talked about his leading tweed for a stretch, and obviously, you know, you started your political career sort of working in the Chris Murphy orbit, and we've talked on the show about, you know, Senator Murphy's really trying to be one of the alternatives in the Democratic Party as they figure out how to operate post this election. I'll just give you my quick take as an unaffiliated voter. I still think there's a bit of a rudderless is a little cliche, but the thing I like about the Republicans in the state is that they're in a huge minority, but most of the time they offer up alternative proposals. And right now the Democrats, I'm getting them telling me that what Trump is doing is terrible and illegal and it's a constitutional crisis, but I'm not getting a lot of alternative proposals.
That's the problem.
And so I don't understand why the Democrats don't see that too. And they don't start figuring out, like, the Ro Khanna was the guy who made the most sense. He's like, yeah, if we don't look at our, just like you said about regulations, if we don't start looking at things and understanding that maybe there is a little bit of bloat in our government, then we're going to lose again. And I don't see enough people saying that.
Well, I think the parties are in very vastly different places, right? And the Republican Party right now is essentially a cult of personality monolith around one person. I'm not saying that's
right, but it's largely true, yeah.
It's whatever Trump says or does, that's what the party then mimics, right? The Democratic Party is leaderless, so we don't have one person that we're reacting to. There's 40 people who want to be president. There's 5 people here that want to be governor. You know, all these people who want to be something. And the incentive structure in my party right now is if I beat up on Trump, I get a lot of likes and I get a lot of things. That's not what's the sustainable thing for us. Do I think what he's doing is not good for our country? I do not. But I think that our way back is to do a couple things. One, talk like normal people. Number two, propose big ideas that are going to help people. Our party has become the party of explaining why things are complicated and hard and defending institutions that most people think are broken. And if I come on the radio and you ask me a question about energy policy and I give you 5 minutes of why it's so hard and complicated, and then I say, well, I'm going to put forward a bill that's going to save your electricity by 5%, people are going to say, get this guy off the radio, right? They want big, bold solutions, and they don't want us to just sit here and defend the status quo. And in large part, our party has become just about defending the status quo.
So why isn't somebody stepping up and doing that in the face of, why isn't there somebody who's starting to do that for the party? I just don't understand why there isn't a movement to do that.
Well, I guess you don't think that I'm doing that, but that's
No. But I mean, on the national level, to be honest, I'm thinking about Senator Murphy when I say that.
The answer is half of the party thinks that the answer is just fighting Trump all the time. And then half the party thinks that we have to fight Trump when we have to fight Trump, but then figure out what's actually wrong with the party. And then there's other people who just don't think we should do anything, right? They focus on we should move left or we should move right. Neither of those answers, to me, is what the answer is. We have to move forward and give people a reason to believe in us again. And for too long, we have just become a party that no longer has that faith. The second thing is we have an identity crisis in the party where we believe that we are the party of the working class, but working class people no longer believe that we're their party.
Correct, yeah.
So the answer to that is we have to figure out, okay, are we just going to be this suburban, college-educated elite party that gets support from different hodgepodges across the state, some from the cities, some from the suburbs, some from people, or are we going to actually figure out who we are going forward and who we want to be the party of, and then actually start figuring out how we can be that party again.
Instead of asking which Democrats you think could emerge and stuff like that, because we only have like 30 seconds before we have to take a break, what is one issue that you think the Democrats is low-hanging fruit where they could make, I'll double up on my cliche,
well,
it's, make some hay?
It's Bill Clinton, right? It's the economy, stupid. That's the number one issue that people care about, right? All these other issues at any poll, they're all just ancillary side things, right? It's what's going to make your life better. In my mind, Donald Trump ran and got elected to make Connecticut and America more affordable. And everything he's done since then actually has made it more expensive to be here. And I think we need to put forward ideas, not just say all what he's doing is bad, but put forward ideas of how we're going to make healthcare, housing, energy, childcare, all those things more affordable and become the party of affordability, because that's what people want.
Sean Scanlon, the comptroller here in Connecticut, joining us here on Brian and Company. We're back here with Sean Scanlon, comptroller here in Connecticut. I want to make sure we get to the budget stuff. I mean, it's confusing for so many people. They're like, we got $4 billion in the bank. We have surpluses, yet everyone's screaming that we don't have money. So in a simple way, just explain to me how that's possible.
There's really no simple way to do it, but I'll give you my best shot
Please,
at it.
Please, thank you.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
10 years ago, we're in a fiscal crisis.
Yep.
2017, we changed the way we budget. We institute these things called the fiscal guardrails that basically change how we spend money, how we save money, how we take certain money that's very volatile and put it away so that we don't have these boom or bust budget cycles. And 10 years later, today, we're sitting here, we've had 7 years of consecutive balanced budgets. We've got all this debt that we've paid off, almost $9 billion of debt that we've paid off, and we've saved that $4 billion you just talked about. And yet, as you said, there's this big conversation happening in Hartford that's very confounding to people because they say, wait a minute, we've got all this money, and yet we have all these things. And that's because of something like the spending cap, which was instituted back when Lowell Weicker passed the income tax, but was really changed dramatically during 2017. And it basically says that you could have all the money in the world, but you can't spend it. And that's what's frustrating the debate right now. They could settle this budget in 30 seconds if it didn't exist for that. And that's the conversation that's going to dominate the next week of the budget.
So when I've been clarified on this, the Medicaid gap or the money they need to come up with is a now issue. That's not even considering what might not come from the federal government moving forward, correct? And do they violate any of the guardrails to fill this current gap? Or they have to change the rules to do it?
They got around the spending cap by declaring an emergency. And people said, wait a minute, how could there be a fiscal emergency when you have a $500 million surplus right now? And the answer is because of the spending cap.
Because they're limited. They can't just spend that money and put it in the budget.
We got the money. Yeah. It's like if you and your wife had the money in your bank account and then you went to go pay a bill that was higher than you expected, right? Let's say that your AC breaks and it's coming to the summer and you got to go and figure that out. You have the means to do it, but there's a restriction on your card that's saying, even though you have the money in your account, you can't spend more than this. And that is what people are really hung up
on. But then the Republicans who are overwhelmingly in the minority say, well, that's actually the wrong way to look at it. We should be maybe not spending this money and shouldn't even have to call for it. Now, they have no ability to affect the outcome, but is there any credibility to that criticism?
Yeah. I mean, listen, they're saying is we have to be able to cut money somewhere. And I am someone who believes that, of course, there is money that we can cut from somewhere. Does that mean that that's not going to be something that is going to upset people? No, it's not. It is going to upset people, but we should be looking at those things. But that's not the only answer either. So it won't surprise you. There's sort of a middle path here, right? Where most of your listeners say, hey, it sounds kind of goofy that you've got a $500 million surplus, but you can't go $5 million over to make sure that your grandma in a nursing home doesn't get kicked out of there because her Medicaid payment is not going to get to that nursing home.
Right.
Or you have a developmentally disabled child that's not going to be able to get help in their group home because of this. But then the idea of the Republicans just saying, well, yeah, we'll just find $400 million of cuts under a couch cushion. It's not that easy to do that. Otherwise, we'd be doing that all the time. You have to find a balanced approach. And I think that that's what ultimately they're going to do and pass the budget.
Well, you know, we're talking with Sean Scanlon, the comptroller here in Connecticut. And you're assuming, though, that when we find out what the federal budget is, we're going to have to reconvene and tweak the budget anyway, correct?
Well, listen, the federal budget's certainly not great for Connecticut, certainly when it comes to things like Medicaid. And again, that's a million people in our state who get covered by Medicaid. And there's misconceptions about who those people are. It is literally seniors in nursing homes, children,
right,
disabled people. It's a million people in our state, the most vulnerable people in our state. And the federal bill that just passed the House and that they're now debating in the Senate cuts that by $660 billion.
So we'd have to come back to the table to figure that out. Do you advocate what Ritter put forth in sort of siphoning off $1 billion and putting it in the rainy day fund? Because I'm sort of fascinated by the rainy day. Like, if that happened, that's a rainy day. But now, for some reason, we don't want to touch the rainy day fund. We want to preserve what it is. We want to add some of the surplus to it so then we don't. So is now the $4 billion the principal of the rainy day, and that's the way it's going to be in perpetuity?
In some ways, you have to look at this like they used to look at the weather. I always joke with my wife, right? We know so much about the weather that's coming right now. But at some point in history, you used to stand there and say, oh, it's getting kind of cloudy. You had no idea what was coming, right?
Right.
We have no idea what's coming. Donald Trump is president for 1,200 more days, right? We're 200 days into his administration. We've already seen $500 million of cuts, and they're trying to cut the single largest program that we get federal money from, which is Medicaid, right? I have no idea what the future may hold. And so there are a lot of people, myself included, who say, look, we may be heading towards a recession, though the progress or the predictions of that have come down a little bit since the tariffs have been walked back. But we may have a recession and we may see more federal cuts and we may just be at the beginning of this, not the end of it. And so we have to be very, very careful when it comes to just saying, hey, we got $4 billion.
So what does that mean in real terms? Are you
what it means in real terms is I think we have to reserve a healthy amount of our rainy day fund for what the future may hold. But I do think that it is wise for us to potentially be a little bit more loose with the rainy day fund if we have to be, if, for example, the Medicaid cut goes through and we got a million people in our state that are getting kicked off their health insurance. I personally can't accept that morally. And I think we should at that point look at what that would cost us.
So, but do you think we should add to it now and make it more than the $4 billion?
I don't think we need to add to it
right now. But you're okay with potentially having to access it if there is some sort of crisis gap in Medicaid?
What Matt Ritter, the Speaker of the House, is talking about and what other people are talking about is, are we saving too much money with this thing called the volatility cap, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And again, we are very reliant on the money that comes in from people on Wall Street that right. live in Connecticut.
He's basically saying take an extra billion instead of putting it to pay down the pension debt, put it in the rainy day fund in case the S hits the fan.
Yes, but there's a couple of different ways to do that. But what he's really getting at, though, is that we're saving too much money, right? And that we're saving too much volatile revenue. And the when they did this in 2017, they picked the worst year to 1 year.
No, I get
not
it.
Not an average.
I get it.
Right?
I get it.
And if you did an average, which I think is fiscally responsible, you could free up $300 to $400 million.
I mean, there's an argument the volatility cap isn't that volatile. It's been basically static for 7 years. But a legislative agenda, you know, I want to make sure you get to a couple things that's going on in the Capitol that you want to talk about. I know healthcare, first responders. Why don't you take me through what's going on?
Well, like I said, pension reform, big thing I'm working on. Hopefully pass that bill today. My dad was a cop. My grandfather was a firefighter last year in the wake of the tragedy in Bristol where we lost two police officers October 2022. I champion this thing called the Fallen Officer Fund, where if a police officer is killed in the line of duty, we give their family financial assistance and health insurance right away. Got that bill passed. We've unfortunately had to use that twice in the last 20 months in Connecticut. We've had two police officers killed in the line of duty. And this year, we're expanding it to the Fallen Hero Fund so that it's any police officer, firefighter, EMT, or paramedic who's killed. So we're trying to get that bill passed in the House. But, you know, listen, it's a crazy time of year. We got 7 days left. They're going to try to jam a lot in that's important. And I hope that some of the bills that are, again, targeted on making Connecticut more affordable pass, and I'm working on some of those too.
Are you there a lot? Like, I don't know the role of it. When we talked to some lobbyists earlier from CABE, the Connecticut Association of the Boards of Education, and I just get the sense between, like, there's a lot of people just there to talk to people, and obviously it's productive and important, but like, are you spending a lot of time at the Capitol?
At the end of the session, yeah. For me, I'm like a recovering legislator, right? It's like Hotel right. California. I can check out, but I can never leave, right? So all my friends are over there on both sides of the aisle, and I get called there a lot professionally, but I'm also just over there personally and, you know, just seeing people. It's where the action is for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, it just seems like it's intense this time. It's gone by really quickly. The in terms of, like, how old are your kids now?
My kids are going to be 3 and going to be 6.
Okay. 6 is the boy or girl? Is it?
I have 2 boys.
2 boys. Are you doing T-ball or, like, what's going on?
I'm coaching my second season of T-ball.
Is that the worst?
It's tough.
I personally, like, I coached T-ball. I coached Little League. I coached youth hockey. I coached youth soccer. I did it all. To me, T-ball was the worst.
My older son is sort of losing interest. So he's a big hockey guy. I've talked about this with you. Yes. Loves hockey. And he's also doing soccer, which my wife is coaching. And compared to hockey and soccer, T-ball is just watching paint dry, right? And so, he's doing it. He loves to bat. But then when we're in the field, we got like 11 kids at any given time. 9 of them are doing something else.
It's cute at some level. But I also feel like it's parents want their kids occupied in something for another hour during the week or whatever. Because I didn't grow up with T-ball. They didn't have, like, you basically went straight to coach pitch and then kid pitch and then you play baseball.
It's tough.
I think it's like a metaphor for, like, youth of America.
It's
like
really tough.
Soft landing with these kids. In terms of education, you know, I just had this conversation with the folks at CABE, and I'm just curious, you know, you're very focused on your job, and I know that. Yeah. You're a former legislature. Maybe you have broader aspirations. We're not going to necessarily get into the details of that right now, but I might ask you about Lamont in a second from a different perspective. But how do you view what's going on with education? You have to pass this extra money for special ed. We know the burden it is on the local municipalities, but things like, also on the macro, it seems like the system isn't a very good system.
Yeah, I think it's great that they're giving more money to special education. It's great that they're giving more money to the towns through ECS, but that's basically just like chipping away at the problem. We need to break what's causing the problem, and that's the broken property tax system in the state that is literally based on how we tax people in feudal England, right? The 1600 tax system is still
in
place.
So you think the education issue is a question of, because it derives all of its funding municipally from the property tax?
Just break down the problem, right? The towns come to the state every year and say, we have no money, give us more money, right? And the reason they have no money is because all they can do to raise money to pay for their schools and their cops and their bridges is to keep jacking up the cost of your property taxes, which is unsustainable. And it's the reason for every problem that we face in Connecticut. Expensive housing, expensive local taxes, expensive, you name it, right? It's all based on the fact that there's this very bad system in place of how we actually fund municipal government.
So what do you do?
You have to break that system, start over, figure out a sustainable way to give the towns other tools in their toolkit. For example,
to tax people.
Sure. But listen, if my local board of selectmen in the town of Guilford, where I live, in the summertime, our population changes. People put their house on Airbnb. It's like a tourist place, right?
Right.
Give the town the ability to charge an Airbnb tax. That might not be what Greenwich or Granby or whoever wants to do, but give towns other options to raise revenue, right? They don't have that option right now. And then we also have to incentivize towns to start sharing services, which is the third rail in Connecticut politics, but it's an important one. We shouldn't be dictating they do it and how to do it. We should be incentivizing them with carrots to say, if you want to regionalize your police department and you're Guilford and Madison and it works for you, we're going to give you more state money.
I have this conversation. I go all over the state. Every other Friday or thereabouts, we throw a dart at that map, and wherever it lands, we go to that town and hope, cross fingers that they have a diner that's open. And we were in Montville at breakfast at Diana's last Friday. And wherever we go, the smaller towns, they have tons of volunteer issues, challenges now with their fire departments and other things. And we have this conversation a lot, and we're very, very bound to our municipal history in New England. But I mean, should we focus on a county level stuff? Should there be, should we, do you believe there should be a change?
Yes. There needs to be. And the best governor we will ever have will be the one-term governor that fixes this problem. And 30 years down the road, people will say, hey, that man or woman did a really good job.
How would you even do that?
You have to just take all the political capital you have if you get elected to that job. And you have to sit everybody down and say, it's the land of steady habits. This system is broken. Everyone knows it, but they're afraid to talk about it because there's no easy solutions to it. And we're not going to leave this room until we figure out how to do something different. And that is what, you know, nobody's bumper sticker when they run for that job is going to say, I'm going to be the property tax reform, municipal reform government guy. But it's what we need to do in Connecticut.
Who knows what the future holds for you? I'm not going
to
say.
But I'd love to do it. I'd love to try.
Would you take that political risk if you had that opportunity?
I would love to try.
Okay, we're going to timestamp that.
I know.
Okay, because it's saying you would even be willing to be a one-term governor to do that.
I believe so much that this is what somebody needs to do. And if I were ever given the incredible honor of having that job, I would absolutely try to do it.
Do you think that with the fact that we're definitely going to have a special session, or 95% likely, you think Governor Lamont will put off his announcement?
I don't think he's in a hurry to make this announcement, but I do think he's going to run. And I think he should run. And I think he, you know, is dealing with a lot of stuff right now and is not focused on politics. He's never really the kind of guy that's focused on politics. I think he hates campaigns, as most politicians actually do. But he's going to get this budget done. I think he's going to be observing what's happening in Washington. And I think he's going to get to the point where he's going to say what he's going to say and do what he's going to do. But I think he's running.
You know, so with the budget cycle, you know, some of these back and forth with Ritter, the future cuts, you don't think that maybe is enough to dissuade him?
Look, I think it's an incredible moment in our country, right? And I think he's done a really good job. I think his poll numbers reflect that people think he's doing a really good job. And I think it's in some ways a moment for him of, you know, continuing to lead our state and move the state forward. And I think people want that steady hand that he's got. And I think that that plays into his decision making.
Sean, I always enjoy the conversations.
Same.
I really appreciate you and you taking the time out of your busy day. Sean Scanlon, the comptroller here in Connecticut.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.